Blog Talk Radio.
Found Masonic Companion, and I'm your host, Dale Graham. Thank you for returning to the fold, and thank you all of you for introducing other Freemasons, brethren, to Masonic Companion. But we need all the support we can get, I think is how you put it. Of course, it makes it more effective to know that that there's a dialogue going on out there with so many of you, and that we're able to contribute something meaningful to the Masonic discussion. I'm a big believer in, and I think most of us are, that the discussion that's been started in the 20th century. It has continued into the 21st century. And I want to use this kind of an opportunity with you to talk about some sensitive topics. And today, one of the things I want to talk about is what saddens me tremendously when I talk to Freemasons about things that are philosophical and esoteric. And the fellow will sheepishly say, I don't think I'm smart enough to follow that. I don't think I understand that. It saddens me tremendously. I respect a fellow saying that type of thing, but I absolutely disagree. I absolutely disagree that there's anything about Freemasonry that a good man can't follow. Maybe that's the humility of my roots, and maybe it's the courage of my background. And remember, I'm the son of a farmer, the grandson of a farmer, the nephew of fishermen and blacksmiths. Since 1794, when Graham's first landed, 1797. First landed on Prince Edward Island and never left, except for some excursions to Boston. Well into the 70s and 80s, before he died, my grandfather concluded contracts for cattle or animals or land with a handshake. Having lawyers around was considered an interference. Nothing could be less despicable than somebody that could be speaking out of two sides of their mouth at the same time, politicians and lawyers, because lawyers would be saying things that the man himself would not necessarily believe. And he was looked at as an oddity. Of course, who could be so absurd? Man of character will understand. The rest, not really important. Truly. Maybe that's why, I was taught some valuable lessons, and how I was taught some valuable lessons. The clamor to get ahead, it's not the marketplace that sets the rules, it's us. Cheating and graft and extortion and lying, deceiving people to get ahead and make profit, that's not right. Never was, never is. I don't like seeing people cheated. I don't like seeing people take advantage of cheating because they have something wrong in their life, exploiting it. I've challenged people that are disabled about this. As you can imagine, am I talking out of turn? Absolutely not. People that know within themselves that they take advantage. Things that they can and should be doing for themselves, but they can play on the sympathies of other people. Now, to generalize and say all people are like that is ridiculous. But those people, I think, are the exception that try our nerves. Majority of people are decent, law-abiding, forthright. This is the 19th day of January, and we're going to talk about things forthright today. I may not see you before Robbie Burns Day. So happy Robbie Burns Day to one and all, the 25th of January coming up. And if you don't mind, I have a copy of my grandfather's volume of Robbie Burns poems. It's a little leather-bound thing. It's seen better times, I can tell you that. In the front of it, he wrote, Burns, born January 25th, 1759, and died July 21st, 1796. And and Byron, he writes, he's a fan of Byron, born January 27th, 1788, and died April 19th, 1894. He was aged, look at this, Grandpa writes, Byron was 26, I think it says, maybe 36, I think, yes. And Burns was 56 when he died. So, and he scribed here, I'll read the last part to you, and may add a few words. Just at page 247. But I'm going to start and just read you a little bit of a poem written to a Graham. And this is written by Burns to Robert Graham of Fintry, Esquire. Robert Graham of Fintry, or Fintry, was one of the commissioners of excise. Of all Burns' friends, writes the author Wilson, he was the most efficient. When Burns was accused of disloyalty, he, Robert Graham, defended him boldly and well. Excise man. Remember the story of Burns. He worked as an excise official for a while. And one day he went to, you heard the story of the woman that was selling ales without paying excise. And they heard that the overseer for the region was coming. And Burns went to her and gave her a nod. You know, that it would be a shame if you were found out. And so she got the message and closed up shop. The official came, checked with Burns. Burns could legitimately claim that there was no illegal activity going on in the village, which at that moment there wasn't. The head official moved on to the next community, and the woman came out of her cottage and began return to selling ales, which was popular to everybody, as you can imagine. That's the kind of excise official that Robbie Burns was. Now, did that gain some level of respect? From men like you and I, it probably did in the area. So he writes to Robert Graham, late crippled of an arm and now a leg, about to beg a pass for leave to beg. Dull, listless, teased, dejected, and depressed. Nature is averse to a cripple's rest. Well, generous Graham lists to his poet's wail. It soothes poor misery, hearkening to her tale. And hear him curse the light he first surveyed. and doubly curse the luckless rhyming trade. Though nature, partial nature, I arraign, of thy caprice maternal I complain. The lion and the bull, thy care have found. One shakes the forest and one spurns the ground. Thou givest the ass his hide, the snail his shell, the enveloped, envenomed wasp victorious guards his cell. The minions, kings defend, control, and devour in all thy omnipotence of rule and power. Foxes and statesmen, subtle wiles ensure. The sight and polecats stink and are secure. Toads with their poison, doctors with their drug. The priest and hedgehog in their robes are snug. Even silly women has her warlike arts, her tongue and eyes, her dreaded spear and darts. Not so the idle muse's madcap train, not such the workings of their moonstruck brain. In equanimity they never dwell, by turns in soaring heaven or vaulted hell. I dread thee, fate, relentless and severe, with all the poet's husband's father's fear. Already one stronghold of hope is lost. Glencairn, the truly noble, lies in the dust. Fled like the sun eclipsed as noon appears, and left as darkling in a world of tears. Oh, hear my ardent, grateful, selfish prayer. Fitray, my other, stay long blessed and spare. Through a long life his hopes and wishes crown, and bright in cloudless skies his sun go down. May bliss domestic smooth his private path, give energy to life and soothe his latest breath. With many a filial tear encircling the bed of death. Before we go on, I'll give you one. We'll talk at the end. I'll read his poem entitled Winter. It's a dirge, and it's from 1787, and this notes as being the oldest, he said, it was the oldest of his printed poems. And in April 1784, he had inserted it in his commonplace book, prefaced with some eloquent remarks. And his brother, Gilbert, affirms it to be a juvenile production, something he wrote when he was a boy. So we'll come back to that. Thanks for indulging me. I always like it when you do that. More on the go today, more than ever. This disconnect of any man who thinks that Freemasonry is over his head. We all think Freemasonry is over our head. A lot of it is. That's why we chip away at it. And that's why we work together. Often, when we're one-on-one, these fellows will sit and talk to me. But to put a whole room of them together would be a tremendous goal. To actually have all of these fellows feel that support and the warmth of fraternity, where they could be encouraged to not necessarily have complete thoughts, but to say what's on their mind. And to get over this, get away from the administration of Freemasonry. You know, for such a long time, our history has been full of stories about administration. Just like for the longest time, some of us were exposed to history as if the only history worth reading or worth repeating was military history. And we find, in truth, military existence is one part of a great cosmos of existence. And there are so many different perspectives, each valuable in their own way. Same with Freemasonry. It's the same. That there's different ways of looking at it apart from the administration. And you can see that, to my mind, perhaps the defining things about an order like ours administratively is a lot like the way people understand the papacy or the Jesuit. You know, you think about what organizations parallel Freemasonry and have been in existence as long as ours. Well, the philosophies were there and the principles and the ethics were there before we had this great organization around us. My goodness, we needed it because as we became more ordered and deliberate, we realized how vulnerable we are. We became the subject and target of attack. Who would have thought that we would attack, we would be a threat to politicians and a source of revenue to charlatans? But such is life, eh? Always in hindsight, people can smugly say, well, of course, Dale, you should have known. Well, hell no. We were just going about our business, having our talks and having our drinks and being with friends. An accommodating ritual. And then we find that we were being exploited, lied. Lies were being told about us. Lies were being told to us. And then there were some sinister things that happened where, because of the privacy of our organization, we were quite vulnerable to slander. Quite vulnerable. Even today, there are many people. I'm just reading a little note. You're going to hear a little bit of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart doing some of his Masonic music. And the person that posted this is lamenting that people that have nothing good to say about Freemasonry should really save their breath. You know, it's in the comments section. It's very sad, but true. And in a way, it tells us that the dishonors that have been placed on Freemasonry will linger in the history for a lot longer. Taxil's work, saying such, you know, absolutely exploiting Freemasonry to blacken the eye of the Roman Catholic Church that he confessed to. Those books that he published and made some money, you know, had content that was completely slanderous. The things that he claimed were part of Freemasonry ritual were abominable, the abominations, just terrible. And yet those ideas you see pop up in sort of very right-wing material even today. This is what Freemasons are about, the risk and danger. So we go about our business quietly, noticing that while people are continuing to say those things, we have to follow our lead and move in the direction of wholesome, gregarious, encouraging support for people who are in need. May the people that are angry with this have all of the resources and have such a rewarding life that they continue. If their vitriol toward Freemasonry is essential to their balance in life, may that continue forever. But it's a life based on spurious comments. The things that are said about us aren't true. We're not perfect, but we're not diabolical either. Never were, never are. And we do feel very proud about that. Now we're going to get into some, you know, I want your help. When we find an idea that we think is just too chewy, you know, a lot of these ideas we have to dissect. We have to take them apart. Remember, we use the science. We use the advantages of the period of enlightenment. It's all part of our history. Well, not everybody has the opportunity to sit down and read, nor the interest. Reading is one way of learning, but that's not the only one. To say that a fellow can't learn by reading isn't to say that he's stupid. Think, realize, and these are things that in the 60s, these were people that were considered dummy. Think about the number of people with dyslexia that are presidents of major corporations, world leaders. Well, not so very long ago, they would have been considered disposable almost. They couldn't learn, so they were stupid. And they were taught that. They were told that. That was preached, that was brayed at them by the school system, by friends, by family. Oh, the poor boy. You know, he's never going to amount to much. Information unlocks those secrets, doesn't it? We create opportunity. And just when we think we have a pat answer, we need to be able to challenge that kind of notion because there's always something more going on that we need to learn that will change our way of thinking. So we share the burden, share that emphasis so that whenever a brother feels that he just isn't, he's I'm too stupid to follow that. It's over my head. That's disheartening when I heard that, even yesterday. That we share that experience. Yeah, we're all in a way stupid at the big picture. Stupid is when there's something going on that we don't quite understand, but we don't make an effort to try and understand it. That's stupidity. The other part is the challenge. There's a lot going on around us that we don't understand. Some of it, most of it, means we need to learn to sit back and contemplate. Man, if we had this kind of patience and balance when we were in our 20s, wouldn't the world be different? Wouldn't our lives have been different? So that idea, the first thing we could do is start to talk about the aspects of a wise man. A wise man never claims to know anything. You can take that lesson from Socrates. I put that in my pocket years ago. I realized with a great deal of comfort, I live in a world of experts. Everybody knows more about everything than me. And I found great comfort in that. Man, some of the foolishness that I hear. But I'm quite comfortable. And I'm not smug or glib about it. It's absolutely true. Everybody. Me, I'm not so much the skeptic, but maybe the Epicurean. I like to weigh things out, calculate. That's why I can talk very candidly with you, I think, about this very sensitive issue that any wise man will have experienced. Now, do we go and clamber up to our brother and say, you have no need to do that? Only if you're really, really wanting to increase the height of the barriers around that fellow. This requires some degree of subtlety. Absolutely. A glance at the history of initiatory practices tells us about a time when entrance to ancient mysteries could include lengthy and life-threatening tasks. We can readily assume this offered a barrier that only the worthy would share a secret covenant. Why else would you want to commit yourself to tasks that would be dangerous, so dangerous? The shadows of that period have grown long and, I fear, weak. Given that we live in a post-Renaissance period, our modern sensibilities would be violated by condoning this behavior. Today, the initiatory practices of ancient and accepted Freemasonry is such a pastiche. We now experience risk during initiation as we do to wild zoo animals on display for our entertainment. We become emboldened being approximate to danger without risk. Today, we have removed accountability from the equation. How then can we possibly expect initiation will allow the worthy to pass if individual accountability is muted? Ultimately, it is the order that bears the problem. For worthy or not, the door has been left ajar. Perhaps we have unintentionally replaced risk of one sort for risk of another, physical risk to intellectual risk. If we believe Freemasonry expects one must read to explore esoteric meaning, all that means is to explore the things that we can't necessarily see, not only with the eye, but with the mind. Apart from, can you see the rhythm of music? Well, you know it. Your foot taps to it. Yeah. Apart from temporary rhetoric, this too has been downplayed. Temporary, see. And it's that old line, you know, to further your Masonic education every day. Oh, it has great meaning only when it's said. Seconds after, it's gone from memory. Do we ever hold anyone accountable to it? No risk, little consequence. That said, how then do we instill purpose? When we remove the rigor, you know that, what did they have? Some of the ancient mysteries had a variety of tasks, somewhere up to 280 tasks. And the most dire that I've read about is being blindfolded and put in a tiny, tiny boat and cast off into rough waters where there was a strong likelihood you would drown. And of course, the task was not to drown, make your way to shore. What did that take? Courage, commitment, ability? You take the blindfold off and find out where you are and how far offshore you are. My goodness. If we believe Freemasonry has expectations, how do we promote that when there's no consequence if people failed? When we removed the rigor, we replaced it with less qualified initiation, removed unique identifiers, and persuasively reduced accountability. The unique identifiers. That fellow has passed that test. That defines him. We don't have that anymore. It's like saying, that fellow applied for it, so we all did. We've, in a way, I guess, we've taken away the task and made it all bureaucratic. Oh, dear. You know, I become a great whatever in the bureaucracy because I've taken the tests and passed them. Did we unconsciously replace the geometry of the Masonic experience with a populist selling point? Geometry being the truth. In geometry, there's fact and there's truth. Even in the contemporary, go beyond the Euclidean geometry, gentlemen, and to look at Mendelheim's geometry, the geometry of clouds, of waves, of drop of water. Have we replaced all of that with something that's popular so we can sell it? It's easy. You don't have to test yourself. Oh, my goodness. And how often when we're doing it, we're meeting with a fellow and talking to him about the order, do we mislead him and encourage the sense that this is requires minimal commitment? Oh, it's only one meeting a month. Oh, dear. We're deceivers. We're in the shadows and we're deceiving the fellow for our own purpose. We want you to come. We want you to sign. We want you to buy into it. Oh, and after, when it's too late, after you've paid your money and you've gone through the experience, then you're going to find out that what it really requires. And oh, by the way, those degrees, and by the way, oh, that commitment, just blow that off. You don't have to read. You don't have to. Nobody's going to make you. How bloody paternalistic we can become in the blink of an eye. From safeguarding the order, we have been soliciting men for far too long in far too many places. It's only my opinion. We safeguard the order by putting tests forward. And either the fellow passes the test or he doesn't. If he does, then we can presume and identify him as one of the worthy. How do we identify that now? We don't. Perhaps it's organizational fatigue. Help me with this question. The question for many is whether or not this is satisfactory. It's a fair question. Can we instill a sense of purpose when facing even more change? Things are changing around us so rapidly. How to do it without the consequence? Especially when, in order to make this equation work, we have to pass on substandard work. We all know the stories of the Ashlar, and we all know the stories of the Master. You present, and the Holy Royal Arch will know this explicitly. It's examined in the ritual. Do we pass substandard work? Well, we're not allowed to. And by God, if you do, the ramifications are dramatic and serious. You stand alone. So, we have things to do today. I'm going to get into the short history of the craft based on provable facts, This copy I have was printed in February 16th, 1963. Man, that wasn't that long ago. I remember the car models that came out. Well, didn't exactly ring my bell, but man. We need to pick up from where we were. You think about it. We need to pick up where we were last time we were together. We were getting into some material on the art and architecture of Freemasonry. I think we can do that again. Yeah, I think it might be interesting. And it fits with what I was saying a little earlier, just passing it on. Fits when we talk about the mysteries. Well, the mysteries aren't something far and off. They're with us. It's like you and I are the same fellows we were 200 years ago. We come from, our personalities are influenced by the cultures, the experiences around us. But our temperament is temperament. And what happens around us is relative to the time. What was considered progress at any given time is relative to the day. There's always a sense of progress. We operate without the oppression, perhaps. We have a different kind of oppression. We have the same fundamental limitations of democracy that the Greeks discovered. History reveals it very, very beautifully. Works for a time, but not for a long time. So, how about you? We'll get into a little bit of the mysteries, eh? Is that all right? I think that might work. I want to share with you a quote that came from a fellow named William J.H. Boecker. He was born in 1873, and he died in 1962. He was a religious leader of sorts, and he said, the thing that he said, one of the things he said that really struck me was, your greatness is measured by your kindness, your education and intellect by your modesty. Your ignorance is betrayed by your suspicions and prejudices. And your real caliber is measured by the consideration and tolerance you have for others. Just keep that in mind, eh? Try and be generous with yourself. Wherever, this is Kevin Heath, wherever there is a human in need, there is an opportunity for kindness and to make a difference. We need to be able to taste some of these things. Just a little bit, not too much. What we're going to get into here is a little too rich. Think of it like a very, very rich meal. And unless you're taught to savor the meal, a nice glass of wine, conversation, to slow it down, to actually experience the taste instead of just crushing it down the gullet. We're not talking about feeding a starving man. We're talking about sitting down to a meal with a thoughtful fellow. So only just tastes, and let the taste mingle. It's like what happens when we sit down and have a good glass of scotch. You don't knock back good scotch unless you're a troglodyte. You savor every drop. Mm. Anyway, like that. We'll talk about mystery religions, okay? Hope you're relaxed, feeling comfortable, well, at least. Interesting day, this 19th of January. I know you're probably all, you know, out there celebrating that Theodosius was installed as the co-emperor of the East Roman Empire in 379. Yeah, can you imagine? We've got something coming up that, you know, I wanted to share this with you. I met, if you've ever had the pleasure of meeting Dr. David Schimmelpenninck van der Rij, he is a professor of Russian history, and he introduced me to this. This is something that's observed in the other part of the world on the 25th of January. So if you're a little bit, you're wanting something a little more out of the 25th than Robbie Burns, I can't imagine what that would be. Yeah. Then tuck yourself into Tatiana Day, T-A-T-Y-A-N-A. And this was the name day of Ivan Shuvalov's mother, Tatiana Rodionova, his mistress, Ivan's mistress, who endorsed his petition to establish a university in Moscow. That's why she's remembered by students. And it, coincidentally, the 25th is also the end of the first term, traditionally, for the academic year for Russian students, and the end of winter exam session, and is followed by a two-week holiday. So Tatiana Day is when people get together and have drinks, and students celebrate the end of their work period. So if you have a glass of vodka near at hand on the 25th, perhaps right after your... The Presbyterians and Temperance members should turn this part of the program off. You can try that about 11 o'clock in the morning. It seems to a little bit of Smirnoff and with a couple of wedges of tomato in true Czech form. Taught to me by a couple of expatriate members of the Czechoslovakian Symphony Orchestra who were managed to find their way over to St. Catharines many years ago. And on a Sunday morning, we're playing trumpet and horn for us in an apartment. Great time. Mysteries. Let's talk about mysteries. Religions are of great antiquity, but in the Masonic context, the most interesting are those of ancient Egypt, invented by Isis herself. The great goddess, the Magna Mater. The Egyptian cults, geometry, and even the great architect have Masonic connections that cannot be avoided. Now, for those of you who see something Masonic in everything in the world, whack your head against the wall a little bit harder. Masonry, what we do is derivative. It's derivative. We see and observe facts and function in the world around us, and we begin to understand certain things. It's not that it was there. The understanding is there for us to discover. It's that it's discovered through observation, and it's consistent. That's why these principles and ethics continue to be valuable hundreds of years later. So you talk about 5th century BC in Greece, and why is some of this still relevant today? Well, rituals included references to secrets that are not seen or heard, but are handed down. And these secrets were presided over by the jackal-headed Anubis. You know, Anubis, the creature that helped us cross the river from life to death, who significantly taught Isis the way when she was searching for the dismembered Osiris. Isaic mysteries were participated in by certain Roman emperors and involved purification, personal piety, and a variety of symbolic journeys with a trial and degrees. Trial and degrees. We go through that too, don't we? Yeah. Hadrian is known to have gone through two ceremonies at Eleusis that had Isaic Egyptian connotations. Enlightenment, or what was in Greek, photismos, initiation as a mysterion, and symbolon was the password, are words that recur in antiquity. Enlightenment, initiation, and symbolon, the password. Symbolon. The term mysterion signifies the obtaining of esoteric wisdom after some kind of endurance test involving trials or ordeals has been passed. Many cults in the Greco-Roman world required initiates to await enlightenment while being kept isolated in darkness. And there are rules concerning silence, patience, and fortitude. The concept of being reborn in the presence of the great goddess Isis after a symbolic death was present in the Aseic cults. An initiate, once reborn, would join a sacred band of chosen ones who would be informed of the divine mysteries by being entrusted with esoteric knowledge. Pardon my German here. Mozart's O Heilige Band der Freundschaft Trainer Brüder perfectly suggests, this is Kirchel 148, if you're looking for the classification, perfectly suggests Masonic ideas of fraternity and a sacred band, and was written long before he became a Freemason. But such ideas were there, often just beneath the surface, and had never died. Such was the strength or survival of the ancient mysteries in one form or another. Herodotus identified Hephaestus with Phita, the Egyptian god of fire and architect of the universe. So Hephaestus was connected with the Greek, was connected with the Egyptian god. That's the point of that. And the demigod, Cabiri, as his sons who were born in Egypt. Late theology of antiquity established links between the great goddess Isis and Memphis, where the temples of the Kabiri and the Phita could be found. Isis, as sister consort of Osiris, was also mother of the god of the Apis bull, the consort of Phita, the sister consort of Isis, right? Osiris. Certainly, it seems that Isis was firmly ensconced through her connections with the Kabiri to Thessalonica as early as the 3rd century BC. Isis was therefore linked to Hemumtep, known as son of Feta, chief architect to King Zoser, and builder of the pyramid complex at Saqqara. In due course, Imhotep, who was a real figure and a real architect, became the divine son of the triad of Memphis and the subject of worship. Imhotep and Isis had a temple at Epidaurus dedicated to them, which was not surprising as both were devoted to medicine and to the occult. Eventually, Imhotep achieved precedent over Feta, and so the great architect of the universe was none other than Imhotep, architect and sage and builder of the Saqqara stepped pyramid. The master mason, as architect, had himself become a god. Ooh. This factor seems to have escaped many Masonic commentators, but it goes a long way to explain the importance of Masonic and Egyptian attributes as mystical objects. Yet, it is clear that it must be taken into account in any consideration of the history and rituals of Freemasonry, for the latter has claims to incorporate the mysteries of later antiquity within its activities. The initiates follow the ways of Cabiri of old and indeed of Isis herself, who searched for Osiris. The syncretic aspects of antiquity are clear. For Osiris, resurrected by Phita, who began and ended the day and who was the deity of masons and architects engaged on building temples and tombs, was also identified with and even superseded by Imhotep, who decreed that a building should be firmly established. In order to do this, Phita, or Imhotep, held a column as his attribute of stability. The fact that Jachin is associated with foundations and establishment, and that Boaz is identified with strength or stability, indicates a syncretism so widespread as to be of considerable importance, and that ancient Egypt is indeed of exceeding significance in the history of Freemasonry. Images of the great architect, of God as divine architect, and of Christ as creator may be a syncretic vision based on the Osiris Imhotep, which is not at all strange when we consider how closely Mary the Madonna, Mother of God, resembles Isis, the great goddess. So we're really looking at information that's pre-Christian. But the ideas and the philosophies that were fused together in Christianity weren't invented in the first century. No, they came from a past, and dominant cultures being Roman and, before that, Greek. During the Ptolemaic period and thereafter in the Roman Empire, Isis, her consort, and Horus, Hippocrates, Harpocrates, had become a trinity associated with the rising and setting of the sun. Skilled practitioners in mathematics, geometry, and inventions, controllers of fire, bringers of heat, light, and life, dissolvers of darkness, the resurrectors of the dead, quite apart from their skills as healers and as architects. Now it is important to realize that the veneration of Isis, Osiris, Serapis, Theta, Imhotep, Horus, and Hippocrates, and so on, was not confined to Egypt, but became widespread in the Greco-Roman world. Ah, great ideas. Osaic legends or theology point to an interesting parallel with Freemasonry. The murder of Osiris at the hands of Seth was the great forerunner, but in the rites associated with the Cabiri, one of the brothers who was killed by other brothers, suggesting the death of Hiram. Apuleius tells us of degrees of trials, of oaths, of secrecy, of passwords, of hidden truths, of passages from darkness to light, and of a victory over death in the Osaic mysteries. Abstinence, fasting, patience, and endurance of long periods in the dark were part of these Osaic mysteries. The term incubera refers to the custom of sleeping in a sanctuary where oracular responses were sought through dreams or necromancy. The candidate was then led to a chamber and thus participated in a ritual journey, passing through all the elements, until at midnight the blazing sun was seen. And the gods themselves appeared. Yet Apuleius, who speaks of journeys to the verge of death, does not tell us of any disclosures, for the rites were secret and the betrayal would bring punishment. See, so we can talk about the ritual, but never talk about what's disclosed as a product of that ritual. Ha, that's the secret. Betrayal would bring punishment. In due course, Apuleius translated his initiate to the great Asaeum in the Campus Martius in Rome, one of the greatest of all temples of Imperial Rome, where he was admitted to a new degree of Isis and Osiris, who were joined in their mother's womb as brother and sister, as husband and wife, in attributes and in ritual. Osiris, the resurrected, the invincible, who was also Theta and Serapis, this is how he was known through time. Amon, Horus, Apollo, Dionysus possessed the all-seeing eye. See, so the same concept was renamed at different periods in history. So rather than having 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different entities, this was one entity but being rebranded according to different cultures and different periods of history. So when you're seeing the word Peta, think of Horus and think of Apollo and think of Dionysus. They all possess the all-seeing eye. For the third degree, the candidate was guided by Osiris himself, the highest among the greatest, and the greatest among the highest, in a mystic union where two became one, and the candidate was alone with the alone, in a sanctuary where serenity, stillness, and silence ruled like gods. So the journey of Adelphius indicates was part of the Aseic mystery, and that which the Neoplatonist writer Platonus connects with the ecstatic elevation of the soul to the divine, could not be revealed, but involved a ritual purification by water, the ducking of the head seven times, a prayer to the Queen of Heaven, Isis, and the donning of different garments or vestments for each of the regions through which the candidate would pass. We have that. We change for each degree. During the ritual journey, the candidate would undergo the mors voluntaria, or voluntary death, yet hoped for rescue and resurrection by Isis. The idea of a journey through various compartments with vestments for each stage before a goal is reached is not confined to ancient esoteric Egyptian mystery cults. Daedalus, the cunning artificer, was revered by the artist guilds in the ancient world, especially in Attica. An accomplished architect, Daedalus was supposed to have invented the axe, the awl, and bevel. His nephew, who invented the saw, the potter's wheel, the lathe, and other tools, attracted the jealousy of Daedalus, who slew him and buried the body, in which act he, Daedalus, was detected. The parallels will be obvious. Daedalus fled to Crete, where he designed and built the labyrinth of Gnosis for the Minotaur. He entrusted Adriana with certain secrets symbolized by the clue of yarn by which she guided Theseus through the maze. And the labyrinth, as we see it, recurs as an important element in this study. The labyrinth, as an emblem or as a form, is a number of communicating passages arranged in great complexity through which it is difficult to find one's way without guidance. It is also called a maze and is an intricate, torturous arrangement of features designed to mystify. Labyrinth patterns were the ancestors of the knots or ornamental patterns found in gardens in the 15th and 16th century. By the end of the 15th century, a knot was synonymous with a maze. Even the Greek key pattern is derived from a labyrinth form. And maze-like patterns recur in the ancient art of many civilizations. Apart from their complex decorative possibilities, labyrinth designs had symbolic and even magical connotations, for they could be protective by leading potential enemies or evil spirits literally up the garden path. And they could also suggest the journey through life itself with many dead ends, wrong turnings, and misleading signs until the correct way could be found and the prize gained. In this latter sense, the labyrinth was a symbol of a journey through one's existence with all its trials and mistakes until a paradise or a rebirth could be attained. Labyrinth designs occurred in the floors of some of the medieval cathedrals, particularly in Chartres. Some of you may have seen it or Google it. So architects were identifying with Daedalus, who's also shown flying from the labyrinth in a relief by Fasano from the Cathedral of Florence. And one Anselm described himself as the second Daedalus in a 12th century inscription in Milan. Even God becomes Architectus Mundi in 13th century representation, showing himself with compasses, an image revived by Blake. We see that long-haired vision of God with compasses leaning over. This memory of Feta Himhotep as sublime architect is not an uncommon design, but recurring in numerous illuminated biblical texts of the Middle Ages. So Osiris and Daedalus, God as architect of the world and medieval cathedral architects have similar attributes. And have they come down to us? Well, absolutely. Absolutely. The all-seeing eye of Feta, the Isaic mysteries, and the resurrection of Osiris are not very far from the center of Freemasonry. Feta's column is not unrelated to Boaz, and Boaz' inner meaning, and Feta was superseded by Hohotep, a real architect. It is hardly surprising that Freemasonry, too, has taken on board some of these themes. A vast organization with a code of conduct, a ritual, a system of morality in which allegory and symbol play their parts, with concepts of trials, degrees, initiations, and secrecies, and with the ideas of ritual, journeys, death, and rebirth after ordeals, has claims to connections with the mysteries of Greco-Roman Egyptian antiquity. The whole of Christendom is permeated with ideas born in antiquity, with Hermetic notions and with themes derived from the Greco-Roman Egyptian cults. The claims of Giordano Bruno, he's 15th century, that the most acceptable theologies had developed in the Egypt of antiquity and that the cults of Isis have exerted an informative influence on Christianity itself should be clear to all but the most closed of minds. Christianity, with its saints, emblems, veneration, and the veneration of the BMV and iconography, owes more, perhaps, to lands of the Nile than to those of the Jordan, at least in the development of cults and arts. Who knew? I ask you, brethren, who knew? We'll take on more of the Renaissance period in Freemasonry, if we don't mind. So we make connections. More and more and more connections. It's context. Now, I think all of this has evolved, but the lessons, the fundamentals are there. And I think it's really, really critical for us to at least pay some degree of attention to them, to those early, early connections. Because when we're going about our business today, as Freemasons, we're being affected by thinking that was developed and being reconsidered and reaffirmed through some of the major cultures of all time. We have not eclipsed that in our 20th and 21st century. The cultures that we have are impermanent. We do not have the legacy of Greece or Rome or Egypt. Just look around us. Things are already in decay and decline. But you would argue, so were they in the ancient cultures? Yes, they were. But those were cultures that passed on new ideas that helped transfix the world and redefined our sense of ethic, our sense of community. And what have we today? Not so much. We've seen some social experiments that are failing. Not that they were bad necessarily, but they need significant adjustment. The depth of character of our culture will be determined on whether we can make those adjustments and what those adjustments are. Obviously, Greeks couldn't do that easily. Neither could the Romans. And from what we can tell, Egypt is still in there, flint to stone, having at it. So, why, thank you, Dale. That was very enlightening. That was most enlightening there, young fella. And it's cold outside. You should all have, I wish for all of you, a tumbler of Talisker's, that nice smoky, peaty single malt. Because in this kind of weather, nothing goes down smoother. This is the weather you should see. It's not something you drink in the summer. You drink it in the dead of winter. This is getting to the dead of winter. So here's the juvenile production of Robbie Burns to Winter. The wintry west extends his blast, and hail and rain does blow. Or the stormy north sends driving forth the blinding sleet and snow. While tumbling brown, the burn comes down and roars Frank Bank to Bray. While birds and beasts in covert rest and pass the heartless day. Ugh, that's what it is. Heartless, so cold. The sweeping blast, the sky o'ercast, the joyless winter day. Let others fear to me more dear than all the pride of May. The tempest's howl, it soothes my soul. My griefs it seems to join. The leafless trees my fantasy please. Their fate resembles mine. Though power supreme, whose mighty scheme these woes of mine fulfill, here firm I rest this, they must be best, because they are thy will. Then all I want, oh, do thou grant this one request of mine, since to enjoy thou dost deny, assist me to resign. If you can't help me, at least let me resign it all. And either way, a resolution. There you go. Good times, eh? Good times. Sinister, intense bugger, I tell you. Anyway, come on. We're going to talk about gentlemen here. From the quarries to lodge rooms. Yes, the history of Freemasons. One of the basic ideas of Freemasonry was that all men, whether upper or lower class, met in the level of the lodge. I'm just going off from my old age. I don't think the level is a step down. I think a level is a step up. We all agree to step up to, because the advantage, we're doing this as in a gain, as in a matter of exploration, the power of common purpose and power of common identity. That, for considering the perspective of the individual, is a step up. And yet, figuratively, we look at that as a step down. All of us, we have to step down. Well, no. No more than the we prioritize family and lodge and our private avocations in terms of a ladder. We do it as a balance point. The center. Good Lord. Hasn't this been expounded over and over again in your ritual, in our ritual? Find that center where we can't err. The center is found. It's like the tip, balancing the universe in the tip of your finger. Everything in perspective, everything in balance. That means there's times when you have to spend more attention to one area than another. But it's to bring it all back into balance. We have not learned anything. And I would say it's not the individual that's failed, it's the order. And I think the order is irrefutable. Oh my. Given the very rigid class distinctions in the 18th century society, this concept of equality was unique and came from the very history of the fraternity. Noblemen asked to join lodges of skilled laborers who worked with their hands for a living, not the other way around. It was the exact opposite of the way elitism usually worked. Usually people are, these obsequious, cloying prats. They're trying to kiss the arse of the bosses. You start to dress and talk and act like that privileged class so that you'll be accepted. Yeah, right. Okay. So this is the turnabout. These are the men of privilege saying, right, you boys, will you let me in? And you can imagine the conversations all these working men would say, what the hell are you about? And I guess it's on the eye of the beholder today. What's considered the working men? Everybody's got a working class status of some sort, except, I guess, unless you're sort of a useless oligarch. And I say useless with the gentlest of intent. Noblemen asked to join. Upper and lower classes and country and city folk were now meeting together and sitting side by side. The concepts of politeness, manners, social grace, better speech, and the value of intellect started to rub off on men who'd never given it much thought before. so everybody wasn't going to be scratching their arse and spitting on the walls. You know? This was the origin of the notion that Freemasonry's purpose was to take good men and make them better. Ah, so the good man was me. And it was to teach me social graces, better speech, and manners, and how to be polite. Okay, I got that. The concept of gentility began to grow and spread, and it was one thing to be tolerant of a man's views and behavior if you knew him well, but it was an enormous change to extend that tolerance to men you'd never met before. As Anderson stated in the Book of Constitutions, quoting, "Masonry becomes the center of union and the means of conciliating true friendship amongst persons that must have remained at a perpetual distance." Makes sense, eh? Now, you know that the Grahams were at one point Jacobites. And so Bonnie Dundee, when you hear that tune, that's about a Graham, murderous bugger, did his job, ruthlessly efficient. And yeah, this had to do with Protestant and Catholic. But it also had to do with, with George III, who didn't speak a word of the language and came from another country and was a different religion and had no interest in learning the language, for God's sakes. So, it sort of pissed a lot of people off. Cracking open the door on French Freemasonry, just a little. And today, as I'm told in Edinburgh back in May, the most exciting and prevalent forthright thrust of Masonic scholarship in the world today is in France. Oh, that I was fluent enough to be able to read firsthand the material coming out of it, but I have to wait for translations, and I fear a lot of people are, even though the rest of the world is catching up to speaking English as the language of business. What could be more eloquent? There's no language that's surpassed it yet of the 7,000 languages that are spoken on the face of the earth. And yeah, 7,000, we're thinking that's probably going to drop down to what's projected, 6 in the future. So common language, common understanding, different way of thinking. Language forms thought, yeah, probably does. To understand the differences in French Freemasonry, you have to go back into English history a bit, to the 1600s and 1700s. France was literally crawling with Englishmen and Scots. We knew a good thing. Yep. For centuries, France had been the place for Englishmen to flee when they were caught on the wrong side of a political war. Well, good God, how many times during the period where, the king was Protestant, the queen was Catholic? Well, right, that's me. Tell me, what do you want? What kind of a legion do you want? Yep, fine, I'll switch. I'll change my socks and I'll switch from one form of Christianity to another. But you know those forms of Christianity made all the difference. So we had to go and hack away at the other form. Good Lord, do we not pass anything on to our Muslim brethren who are going at it about different forms of Islam? Well, it's not that we're saying, gee, aren't you guys daft? It's like we were bloody out of our minds, murderous, and look where it got us, and look where we are today, and can you possibly, maybe not, but can you possibly learn from what we did hacking away at each other? Senseless. France was a mostly Catholic country, so it was a haven for English Catholics whenever any Catholic sentiment ran high. One fight in England took advantage of this haven more than any other. The Restoration's King Charles II probably had more illegitimate children than any British monarch before or since, but he had no legitimate heir to the throne. Well, good Lord, who hacked the head off his father? Who's the Parliament had to kill his father, and then they looked up and said, oh, Jesus, Cromwell, he's not exactly, he's a bit of a lark, isn't he? And then you look around and say, how the hell can we have a country without leadership? Well, the only type of leadership that the Britain had known was a monarchy. So we can smugly sit back and say, oh, yeah, morons went back and put a king on the throne. Yeah, well, fine. You weren't there at the time, and I wasn't there at the time. And did they have anything better? Well, obviously not. So they put his son back. Can you imagine what that must have been like? To be in the same room where his father had been sentenced to die by the same parliament. Good grief. I'm not saying that I'm a monarchist, but I'm saying this is just a remarkable bit of history. So Charles had no legitimate heir. He had fun. He had friends, but he had no legitimate heir. He had deep Catholic sympathies, but he was wise enough to keep it under his hat to get back in and stay in power with the most, you know, Parliament at the time was mostly Protestant. Then when he died, his brother, James Stuart, became King James of England and the second, and James the Seventh of Scotland, because Charles and James were both great-grandchildren of Mary, Queen of Scots, of course, and legitimately entitled to the thrones of both countries. The problem was that James, like his great-grandmother, was openly and crazily Catholic, rabidly, and he was determined to make England Catholic again. Like, oh, here we go again. These poor nations, haven't they had the bottoms kicked out of it from under them, which didn't go over well in the country that was settling down as a predominantly Protestant. It's like, you know, did it matter? It was just, you know, after a matter of time, you just get worn down. Well, this has been hundreds of years. Like, enough. And when that line was drawn, it was coincidental that it was Protestant on top. It was like, it didn't matter. It didn't matter who was on top, who was winning, who everybody lost. Everybody was looking stupid. And it had just exhausted everybody. So almost immediately, here comes James. So, well, I'm the king. I'm going to make us all Catholic. To hell. It's like, Jimmy, did you not pay attention to the last 75 years? Did you not pay attention to what we did with Chuck the First? Well, we got rid of that bugger, and look at what his son did, you know? Have you not, you haven't figured it out? And did you not notice that you don't have much money because you're running your armies into France? You know, like, give it up, buddy. It's over. Almost immediately after becoming king, he went on the religious warpath, blah, 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 persecuting Protestants, trying to pack Parliament with his supporters. And he kept his religious views to himself. Charles Chuck II might not have gotten in trouble, but Parliament was ticked. He had no intention of a pro-Vatican papist king ever again. James was pitched off the throne in a brief uprising known as the Glorious Revolution, and naturally fled. Ooh, those Catholics over there in France, where do you think he headed? Meanwhile, his Protestant daughter, Mary, and her husband, William, were installed in joint rulers in 1689. That was kind of an interesting period, William and Mary. And the men who wanted to put James or his offspring back of the throne were called Jacobites, after the Latin version of James. We knew that, yeah. France became a haven for them. Jacobites were a magnet, not just for Catholics or Scots, but for anyone that had a gripe against the crown. And France's kings lapped this one up. You know, they'd been just taking stick from England for how well ever. Like they're innocent, eh? When they found England was a little bit wobbly, they were giving her just as good as they got. England and France were constantly at war during this period and used the Jacobites to annoy the English with a favorite pastime for French kings. More fun than a boar hunt or shopping for a new mistress was just pissing the Brits off. So go for it. Piss the English off. It was a large number, and here they're being handed it. The Jacobites are coming over saying, oh, whoa, we've got attitude. It was a large number of Jacobites living in exile in France that helped to make the development of French Freemasonry so confusing. So many variations of Freemasonry sprang up that cataloging them is nearly impossible. Some historians claim that the first Freemasons in France were guards for the Stuart family while they were in exile in Saint-Germain. No matter how they got there, English and Scottish Freemasons were all over France. And in 1728, they formed the Grand Lodge in Paris. It wasn't too long before there was a competing English Grand Lodge of France. France had so many English Freemasons that the Grand Lodge didn't have a French Grand Master for many, many years. Other competing Grand Lodges quickly appeared. Believe it or not, you're ready for this? You're sitting down? Take a sip of your beverage, of your Kool-Aid, and get your fan out. We don't want you overheated or too excited. Or you know you're Freemasons. You know, you get really excited about this. deaf. But the English Masonic feud between the ancients and moderns spread to France as well. Get that, huh? When we get ticked and pissed off, it doesn't matter where you are. Are you with us or against us, boys? The equivalent of the ancients in France were more Scottish-oriented. They wanted to keep the old ways and ceremonies, but they also began to develop new and more numerous Masonic degrees based on old biblical and Templar legends. The French equivalent of the moderns, on the other hand, became less enchanted with any sort of religious connection to Masonry or higher degrees, and in 1773 they formed the Grand Orient of France. The Grand Orient came to be identified with the French Revolution in 1789. Man. And after it. By the way, the Jacobites, you see the terms Jacobins and Jacobites in French politics and history. But that's France. Eh? So there you have the shorthand version of the Jacobites and the connection with France and the development of the Grand Orient of France and the English Grand Lodge of France. So you see that Masonry, is it any surprise? And what can we now that Freemasonry is being, you know, the scholarship has gone to France. You know, the best and the brightest are looking carefully at what's going on there. Well, what are we going to discover? Well, it's enmeshed. It's not like, oh, those Frenchies over there and, oh, those Limeys over there. No, it's all brethren, and they're enmeshed politically, religiously, culturally. There was a time, I must find you the quote, when there wasn't a strong distinction between English and French. That the dialects were so strong that if you were living in the next valley, you may not understand what your people from the neighboring valley, the next valley over, were saying. And I don't mean the distinction of the Gaelic. This was a distinction that permeated Britain and France. Remember, this was people that were intermingling, were trading partners, were fighting back and forth, yeah. But there was much, much more going on. So at least when we sit back at arm's length and say, are you out of your mind, James, Jimmy, you're going to try and make this into what, a Catholic? Jesus, where have you been the last couple of hundred years? Like, pull your head out of your arse there, boys. Now, you can see it. I just said enough. Good idea. It's not like we hate you. Like, we love you. You know, you're one of the boys. You know, we just love you like family. But you're deaf, you crazy deaf bugger. We just can't afford to slaughter each other. We just, frankly, we don't want to slaughter those French guys anymore, and they want to slaughter us. Like, let it go. Jesus, man. So we did, begrudgingly. Somebody said, if you don't stop that, we're going to kick the arse off you. And what did he do? He went back to France, which is probably not a bad idea. Nice climate, good food, even at the time. Lots of mistresses. He carried on. And we know him as the Jacobite. And so today, or around Robbie Burns Day, you know, when you take your toast, you know the Jacobite toast. If you don't, I can't tell you. But go and find out. There's a little configuration you'll see across the oceans. Some of you, particularly the Irish out there, will absolutely know this one. Eh? But we're hands across the oceans. We have made our peace, and we're still developing. And if that's a model for stupidity for anybody, all the rest of the world, take a look at the stupidity that our ancestors portrayed very passionately for very, very important reasons and ready to die for. And at the end of a draw line, say, does this all add up? Well, you know what we might be facing is that this kind of carnage and silliness and the rhetoric is all inevitable. It's inescapable. I hope I'm wrong. Want to know about deism? Of course I do, Dale. I want to work it into my conversation. Well, let me tell you. Another one of those little fireside chats where you can just daze and amaze everyone around you with your knowledge of deism. I want you to work this into a conversation today, you know, or this week, before we talk again. It's vital. Deism, it's a term, it simply means the natural religion. Remember you heard something about the religion, what faith is Freemasons? Well, we have the faith that all on which all men can agree. Well, that's referred to as natural religion, isn't it? And we all scratch our heads and say, geez, you know, I'm not really sure. I'm an Anglican. I'm not really sure the difference between that and a Presbyterian. And truthfully, I don't know about the difference between that and a Reformed Jew and or contemporary Catholicism. I'm not really sure. It gets right down to it. So here we say, all of that aside, you know, go wash your socks. And all of that aside, you'll come back with something called natural religion. If the scientific method of investigation worked, and you know that we're under that period of rational philosophy, aren't you? Fact, you replace superstition with fact, thank goodness. You know, it's not the big scary sun that we have to sacrifice things to, it's the banker. Sacrifice all our worth to the banker because they're the new sun. If we don't have the banker around, we don't have heat. The crops don't grow. They'll take our farms, wouldn't they? Damn. Sorry, we can't laugh about that one anymore. If the scientific method of investigation worked for natural and technological subjects, then scientific theories might also be applied to society, government, and religion as well. Out of this thinking sprang the religious concept of deism. Not just Catholicism and Protestantism, I like those isms, and Christianity itself, and all organized religion began to be questioned as a corruption of a natural religion. Now that's how you, now that sounds like somebody with a, with scripture stuck up there, you know, saying, well, it's a corruption. Well, no. So move sideways. I'm not thinking here that deism, natural religion, is a corruption of anything. I think of it more like fresh air. Before the variations on the theme, you know. This was a philosophy known as deism, and it taught that although God existed and created the world, he had never revealed himself to man. According to deism, the Bible contained many important truths and teachings. Yeah, but God had not written it. Well, yeah, okay. Nor was Christ the Son of God. Okay, let's hear what you got to say about that. Mere faith was no proof of the Almighty. The deists felt that belief in God had to come from experience. What do you mean? That wasn't atheism, the belief that God doesn't exist, but it was just as heretical to the leaders of every Christian church. Yep, they're burning the crosses, aren't they, already, without taking a moment. What do you mean? That the belief of God had to come from experience. To the deists, God made the world, and he made it as perfect but complicated as a machine. A favorite comparison was that God was like a divine watchmaker, and after the earth was created, it needed no further tinkering with. Deists did not believe in miracles, prophets, revelations, or for that matter, saviors. God was impersonal. But that did not mean the deists felt alienated from or ignored by him. They felt awe and reverence for God, because the discovery of his divine plan required personal growth and a constant search for knowledge. Am I a deist? Holy shit. One of the earliest criticisms of fundamentalist Christians about Freemasonry was that it sure walked, swam, and quacked like deism. They felt that the religious tolerance espoused by Masons was nothing more than a cover for the heretical questioning of Christian beliefs. Thus began a long-standing misunderstanding of what goes on in a Masonic lodge. That has not stopped many outsiders from believing that Masons engage in some sort of peculiar pagan religious worship within their lodge rooms. Jesus. Well, I can attest, if in, you know, to the silent majority out there, ain't true. Nope. Not unless malarkey or somebody spinning a yarn out there is considered heretical, more silly or irrelevant. But no, those aren't the types of things that, in good company, whether it's handled roughshod or not. That's not the type of thing that would occur in Masonic Lodge, unless it was relevant to an ongoing discussion, you know, some kind of thoughtful educational discussion, as it is here. We're not sitting here expounding on this and saying this is the way. We're not trying to convince anybody. We're simply defining what this term means. So give it a thought. Does it have some relevance to you? Probably does, huh? Probably does. Because are we seeing the answer in front of us, the faith that on which all men can agree? I don't know. You may have one in mind. But this seems to strip away that notion of competitiveness, of competition for the souls of men, of people. There is no competition. It is what it is. God is what it is. And as soon as we begin to define it, we're making it something that it isn't. In some ways, it's part of our being that's beyond our minds, the human mind, the lowly human mind. But that I'm not in the state that I'm in because I've corrupted anything. So if somebody's saying that is the faith that deism is a corruption, no. In the meantime, you live and let live. Maybe more Buddhist. Eh? You live and let live. Or you find it a little more strident in the Janus, who value life above all else. Now I'm going to cut me off here. I've got a little bit here on the Jesuits and a bit on creating constitutional societies. So I'll come back to constitutional societies next week if you're okay with that. That's a book that I picked up some time ago called Living the Enlightenment, Freemasonry and Politics in 18th Century Europe. And that's by none other than Margaret C. Jacob from UCLA. And if you she's a very, very forthright scholar. Excellent. And we did try to get her to subscribe to the Sankey lectures, but her itinerary wouldn't allow it. She's that popular. You find that the more enlightened Grand Lodges are embracing this type of introduction of scholarship, unvarnished scholarship about Freemasons that's not within the bias of Freemason Masonic culture. As our Grand Lodge here, Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario, has done. This has injected a new stream of information that it's feeding a hunger that's been within the order for many, many years. And our Grand Lodge has taken a very, very important step. And, 2015, you keep that in mind. We've got the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry coming. A redefining experience again. I sit and try and find parallels. There's times if I'm going to compare what's going on with Freemasonry, I want to compare it with something first that has had some longevity. It's been around this long. And that could be rather daunting, a daunting process, because there's not a lot of things that have been around as long as the Masonic Order. So I have a good friend who was trained as a Jesuit, he went on he left the Society of Christ and went on to be a medical doctor, a very good, very dedicated man, as I would attest, he's a very humble fellow, but enormously bright and lovely, lovely person, cares about his patients. But what we learned is the Jesuits were sort of the thoughtful, thinking element of the Roman Catholic Church. And so they were a threat. They didn't do things because somebody was telling them, this is a daft idea. Now I've said this is the way it is. Well, these are the men that said, we'll take a look at that. Thank you very much. You send us the manuscript. We'll take a look at that. And we'll get back to you. How's that? Well, that's not a group of people that you can lead around by the nose, is it? Oh, and do they ever step forward? Did you know that what I just said about them? No, no. It's not important. It's not important for them to be out there a part of the ongoing popular argument. But you and I are part of an order that subscribes to the same belief. It's not that people say what they want to say. They have the, you know, everybody has a valid opinion. A lot of it is just tripe, but it's valid tripe. Do we get into it? No, no. It's not purposeful. The Jesuits, if you troll around the internet, sooner or later you come across the connection between Freemasons and the Jesuits. The official name of the Jesuits is the Society of Jesus, and it's a religious order of Catholic priests. It was formed in 1534 by Ignatius Loyola, a Spanish nobleman who joined the priesthood after being wounded in a battle. The order requires chastity, poverty, and obedience, like most of the holy orders, but from its beginnings it also stressed total devotion to the Pope. The Jesuits refused to take higher-level Catholic offices unless the Pope requires them to. And the Society of Jesus prefers to serve the Church primarily through higher education. Loyola University in Chicago is a Jesuit school, and many cities have Jesuit high schools. The Society of Jesus was created hot on the heels of the wave of Protestantism that swept across Europe, and the Jesuits led the charge in what was called the Counter-Reformation. Some historians have characterized the Jesuits as the Pope's shock troops. Oh, where did they come up with this, man? The Society of Jesus fought hard against the ideas of the Reformation, and in many cases, the Jesuits gained a reputation of craftiness and deception in the psychological war against Protestantism. Oh my, they were thoughtful. In France in particular, the Catholic Church had enormous power and influence throughout the country. Bishops and archbishops held important positions in the king's government. The trouble was the old guard of the church hierarchy did not trust the Jesuits. They spent centuries getting cozy with the kings of France, but the Jesuits had the special favor of the Pope. Politicians would just hate that. The Society of Jesus quickly took over the higher education positions, or what we would call high schools and colleges, and they were very, very successful. They were also educating the children of the ruling classes, so they had enormous influence in shaping young minds to their way of thinking. The Society of Jesus grew quickly, and in the mid-1700s, Jesuits were all over Europe, canoeing down the Mississippi to the United States and even establishing schools and missions in India and Japan and China. Greater than their educational achievements were their missionary exploits. Their success in converting pagans and non-Christians around the world came from their adaptability. They took local customs and cleverly adapted their teachings to Catholicism, so it was not in conflict with local customs. The technique was successful but heretical to the thinking of most other Catholics. Ooh. This led to the accusation that the Catholic Jesuits were devious and would use any method to achieve their goal. Opposition to the Jesuits grew from competing Catholic orders. Jesuits were the confessors to the kings and queens of Europe and taught their children. Because of those close relationships, their contacts created a network of secret informants. Less diplomatic people would call them spies. They were accused of secretly controlling the Pope and working behind the scenes. I thought that the Masons were controlling the Pope. Wait, wait, wait. Move over here. We can't have two orders controlling. Or was that the banks? All right, you guys take the Pope. We'll take the banks. Worse, they were accused of being tainted. Can you imagine if they've ever seen us trying to balance the budget for a lodge or buy a new carpet and then to accuse us of controlling the world banks? I mean, you're laughing with me? Oh, dear. Great, great. Conspiracists would not like to be in a committee of general purpose. It would be such a shock. They'd say they were relying. They would absolutely walk away and say, well, that was just put on for us. I can attest. It's the truth. There, I'm straightening the tie here. Get the tuxedo back on. Oh, man. So, So they control worse than controlling that. They were accused of being tainted by their worldwide contacts with foreign cultures and of subverting true Catholic doctrine, whatever that is, was or is. They were also despised by Spain and Portugal because the Jesuits prevented Indians in Central and South America from being enslaved by creating protective religious states. Ooh, yeah, don't you know you can get the go in, kick the crap out of the native folks and get them to work in the mines so that you can take all the ore and all the whatever and send it back to the motherland. Yeah, of course. Except the Jesuits came in and said, well, wait, hold on, wait a minute. That's BS and you guys know it. And cut it out or we're going to call the king. And we'll route the call through the Pope's office. And that means we'll threaten excommunication if he doesn't get you buggers in line. That sounds more like the way it happened. Hmm? Between the competing Catholic orders and the Enlightenment, thinkers who wanted to strip the Catholics of their property, schools, and influences, King Louis XV was convinced to throw the Jesuits out of France, and Pope Clement XIV dissolved the order in 1773. They went underground, and many fled to Prussia and Russia. Curious, because Prussia was Protestant, and Frederick the Great was a Freemason. Ha ha, there you go. The order was invited back to France by Napoleon in 1814, and Pope Pius VII reinstated them. It was like, whoops, you guys really buggered up with that. Over the years, a variety of conflicting stories have been presented about the Jesuits and Freemasonry. Some have accused the Jesuits of being the secret Freemasons of the Church, controlling the Pope from behind the scenes and subverting true Catholicism with foreign unchristian doctrine. Others have claimed the Masons were the enemies of the Jesuits and conspired to shut down the order in 1773. Once again, have you ever attended a committee of general purpose? Shut down the order. Still others claim that Freemasonry, especially some of the French and Bavarian variations like the Illuminati, were invented by the Jesuits to help to ultimately restore the Catholic Stuart kings to the throne of England and make Britain Catholic again. They're Jacobites. An allegation has made the grounds of a secret oath allegedly taken by advanced members of the Jesuits, which justifies any action, including infiltration of other faiths and murder in the name of the greater good of advancing Catholicism. Jesuits have been accused of killing presidents and popes as well as starting revolutions. They sound like they're Freemasons. Everybody's accused us of that kind of crap, haven't they? Have they stopped doing that? Again, give your head. More than a few believe the two are inextricably linked. Well, if they're saying that we're both enlightened and we're scholars and we're students, that's a compliment. Thank you very much. If you're saying we're sinister buggers and we're up to this subversive control, well, is it subversive to take the pins out from under a despot that's killing a lot of people? Is that subversion? How do you redefine freedom fighters, you know? The underground in France that fought back in the Second World War, people, men and women, that tried to do whatever they could to fight off the enemy. You know, is that what you're saying is wrong? Dear me, dear me. An allegation has been made that the rounds of a secret oath allegedly taken by advanced members of the Jesuits, well, that's said by us too, that there's secrets that really most of us are a little bit deaf, but we're kept away from the dire secrets and that only go to the 33rd degree. I've never heard that, you know. These higher-ups in our organization are the people that are the perpetrators of all of these bad, nasty things. But we would never know that because we're kept in the dark. Man. If this all sounds identical to this conspiracy suggested about Freemasons, bang on. More than a few believe the two are linked, no matter who came first or their evil plans, and that both should be, some of you should fight against them. If that were the case, we wouldn't be existing this long. If we were based on that kind of nihilistic exploitation and aggression, we would not last, because the world around us disposes of those types of people. Vlad the Impaler would not do well today. You want to say what's going on on the African continent is equivalent to Vlad? Not even close. Not even close. Because both speculative Freemasonry and the Society of Jesus appeared at the same time. Because both used elements of different religions and societies to affect their methods. Because both attracted intellectuals, had high standards, and espoused strong moral values. And because of the air of secrecy that surrounded them, both wildly differing accusations of conspiracy seemed to connect them to each other. Proving any of these accusations is another matter. Proving? Fine. I always think that intelligent people can, if you're thinking emotionally, you don't have control of your emotion, then you can come up with the most outlandish proofs, quote, in quotations, to substantiate what you're saying. The Flat Earth Society still exists, and there's people out there that are still very, very clear that the Earth is flat. But, you know, of course, the pictures from outer space where all that junk is flying around, God bless the Japanese for coming up with a disposal system that's going to be up there next year, just nursing all those bits and pieces of junk into the, so it burns up. But, you know, there's still people that would think that. And even in the day, those were very well-intended, solid people that said, no, there's the horizon's flat. And over the edge, there's nothing except dangerous things. It's a great unknown. Oh, it's dark and scary, so it must be bad. Well, no, not so. Not so. It's been interesting talking with you today. I think there's more energy and more of an uplifting, positive thrust to Freemasonry today than in the past 100 years. We have the ability to poke our head up, stand up on our hind legs, and look around. And what do we see? Some really industrious people. Yes, we can see the door of a lodge that needs another coat of paint and a stairway that needs a repair. But these buildings were not made to endure forever. They weren't made of stone. They're made from local materials. You know, when I come back to the thinking about that one day when we have our proper Grand Lodge building, the cathedral, big enough and significant enough for all of us, I ask myself, what would we make it out from? Would we take it from the granite? Would we make it out of the shield? Yeah, Precambrian shield. I like that. Something permanent. Or would we make it out of the wood? But then wood has to be, it does deteriorate, doesn't it? Probably granite. Yeah. One day and where? I've got some ideas. I'll talk to you about that. I get to dream out loud with you about where it would be. It will. This is inevitable that it will come. You know, it will. We will have one day a proper Grand Lodge building, and I hope it's within your lifetime. I hope it's within mine. Now, I want to share with you a little bit. This is we have a lot of conspirationalists running around. Let's make sure that they know that if they need to talk, if we can listen to them, but we can't change what we are. We don't have that gene. We're not to get people or control minds. We are just as what we appear. Men going about our business, trying to live a good life. Just like the people that accuse us of that. Same thing. I'm trying to live a good life. And I'm not always getting it right. Now, this is called the Freemason's Cantata, or Freemason's Music. And it's by our brother Mozart. Have a listen. It's a winter's day. Finish off your Talisker and go out and run out and get another one. Eh? Finish it. Go out and get another tumbler of it. I hope the harmonies and the harmonics that have always been part of Freemasonry are coursing through your veins today. That you not only talk about being a good man, but you act that way. That you perform an act of kindness for somebody as an expression of your Masonic belief. And protect the principles that are so close to our hearts. May the great architect of the universe watch over all of us. And Neil Young says, you just keep rocking in the free world. Once upon a time, our brother, Mozart, was rocking in a free world.
Yeah. Thank you.
See you soon. Thanks for joining me.